Thank you for tuning in to NJRR Live. We welcome Dr. Flavio Hickel to talk with our host Christian Perez about Latinx voter trends and many other issues surrounding Latinx communities around the United States. Thank you very much for being a part of New Jersey Revolution Radio this year. It was because of your support that we made it through a very difficult year, and we will need more support next year because we don't plan on treading water. We plan on growing in 2021 because these issues that we deal with never went away. They've lingered throughout this pandemic, and as that pandemic hopefully comes to a close next year, we need to be prepared to, you know, create a new world. And I look forward to doing that here on Revolution Radio with all of you. Please show your support by donating www.njrevolutionradio.com. Thank you very much. Happy holidays to all of those who celebrate, and a happy new year to everybody. See you soon. Peace.
Jumping right in, I want to get started. If we can bring Brian in, that'd be great, because Brian's going to talk to us. Brian's going to talk to us about some of the things, about some of the issues we've been covering here in New Jersey Revolution Radio with regards to the ICE detention centers up north. There are a number of Democratic organizations in Mercer County, and I believe it was, Bergen County. And Brian's going to talk to us about that. Brian, if you're ready, if you can give us the 411, that'd be great.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot for, you know, covering hosting duties again for the last NJR Live of the year. We're going to take a little break after this and enjoy holidays and New Year celebrations and do some work behind the scenes. But we'll be back later in January. So we're going to take a few weeks off. But, thanks for seeing us out here as we wrap up a horrible year for everybody, and generally trying to stay on the positive side. And we'll try to get into some positive stuff. And as I tell everybody, that's why we do art and activism, because art is around to help cheer us up sometimes. And, what I'm going to go over has been, I guess the most important thing we've been covering in my mind, and what's really been weighing on me as I prepared for tonight's show, was the immigration issues going on in North Jersey. And for those of you that haven't had an opportunity yet to look back and see Jake Efros in his interview, I strongly encourage people. It's out on podcast now. It's called Democrats Goose Stepping with ICE. The problem is all over North Jersey. There are four ICE detention centers in the state of New Jersey. And I think that, it's life or death for so many people. And, I want people to educate themselves as to what's going on, because, it's a problem that's man-made and it can be fixed by people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shame because, like, COVID-19 has kind of taken over everything. It's taken over every aspect of our lives. It's taken over the national conversation. And in 2016, the big issue nationally, the big issue for the Trump campaign, for Trump, was immigration. And then fast forward to the 2020 debates, and we don't even hear them talking about immigration, right? So children are still in cages. Families are still being separated. The government has lost track of thousands of these. Well, they haven't lost track of these children. They know where the children are, but they lost track of the families. So it's still very much an issue. It's something that hasn't gone away. And to see Democrats up north, Democrats, which are supposed to be the party of the people, the party of immigrants, to see them literally selling out so that they can lock up what is predominantly brown bodies is a shame.
Specifically in North Jersey, I mean, we just had a hunger strike that was ended after 30 days. We had arrests where Gestapo-like police were clashing with activists over barriers. I mean, physical confrontations between authorities and activists, people on hunger strikes.
Yeah.
And then you have public officials saying, comparing the detention facilities to college dormitories. And one of the arguments being made out there, Christian, is that somehow, Joe Biden's coming in and everything's going to be okay, or that North Jersey facilities are better than other concentration camps, so we'd rather have them here. I want to make it very clear that first off, immigration is not a crime. Being here without a legal status, it's not a criminal offense. It's a civil violation. And so to right off the bat, by treating anybody, first off, nobody, regardless even if you've treated a crime, should be treated in the manner in which some of these people are being treated in North Jersey. And there were some statistics coming out specifically related to Hudson County, which, you know, Joey D and all those criminals and Nazis up there have been saying is a great place to be, according to them. There's been the use of solitary confinement 85 times in Hudson County, 100 strip searches, and 9 times they've deployed chemical agents, maced people or whatever. And if you want to ask why have they strip searched people 100 times for when they're being held for a civil violation, it's because those were the conditions that had to be met in order for them to see family. So they were locked away from their wife, their husband, their spouse, their kids, or whatever. And the only option they had to have any contact with their loved ones was to submit to a pig looking up their asshole with a flashlight or something like that. And yeah, to be in an already humiliating situation and then continue to be subject to these conditions. There is a bill that was just announced, and I don't know where it is. I saw it. There's an article out by Assemblyman Gordon Johnson that would stop any new contracts or any renewal of ICE contracts in New Jersey. However, the contract in Essex is undetermined. It could be it's kind of an infinite contract, if you will. There are other contracts that still have 4 and 6 years left on it. And I don't think, as always, it's not good enough. I mean, people are applauding it, and the initial reaction from, you know, the more aligned liberal circles are saying, oh, this is a great step forward. But the bottom line is, all I'm hearing is Murphy approved protests. And I would suggest to people taking the foreground in this fight to put the interests of the people who are incarcerated first, and not who's going to get credit and who's going to win an election afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame because COVID is running rampant in these facilities. They can't social distance. There's a shortage of PPE. And since there's already a stigma against people that are locked up. And again, like you said, these people are not like criminals. They're immigrants and they're being locked up for that. Yeah. But in cages, Americans have already made decisions about them. Interestingly, I do see this in the article, and Brian had sent me an article earlier, is that 5 correctional staff at the Hudson County facility and at least 1 member from Elizabeth have actually died from complications due to COVID. So yeah, it's not something that's killing the people that are detained. It's killing the people that are working there, too. So if they're not...
Prisons are communities in their own right. And I lived very close to prison, you know, when I lived in Woodbridge. And, you know, I would go into Quick Check in the mornings and every day or Dunkin' Donuts or wherever, you know, the pigs were on their way in and out of work. And you would see them in their corrections gear with their shirt untucked, you know, on their way. And so they would come right out of that prison. And many times I saw them early on in the pandemic not wearing masks. Looking like they just wrestled a bear coming out, you know, it did, you know, so, you know, they're not, this isn't a matter of just the people in prisons being safe, but it's a matter of all of our communities being safe. And as we've seen this, you know, it's a virus. It doesn't really care who you are or where you're at when it finds you, you know, and it can find you through the prison system, even if you're not an incarcerated individual.
Yeah. I mean, we as everyday citizens in the United States were underprepared for this virus, you know, free people, right? Citizens. I can't imagine like the frustrations and the fears and the uncertainties that are going on when you're incarcerated. And it's like, again, these people they're not violent people. These aren't murderers. These aren't, you know, these aren't killers. They're people in search of a better life, right? Immigration happens because there's push and pull factors and there's economic reasons and there's environmental reasons that people are coming to the United States, why people are leaving Africa and the Arab world to go to Europe. But, you know, this country, we would rather lock people up than actually address the reasons for immigration. There's direct correlation between the politicians we vote for, the laws that they pass, and the immigration that follows. But, you know, as I said, Brian, you've heard me, you know, beat that dead horse. People don't want to do the work. People don't want to learn. It's easier to just blame immigrants or blame Jews or blame Mexicans or whoever. It's easier to just blame people than to actually, you know, educate yourself on the facts.
Yeah, man. And I think that, you know, this immigration issue is one that unfortunately will get worse before it gets better. I don't see all, you know, Joe Biden did not even bother to campaign to progressives. He was openly campaigning against Medicare for All, the Green New Deal. And he remained more or less kind of quiet about immigration. I mean, he didn't really have much of a campaign at all other than he wasn't Donald Trump, which is for most of the country good enough. And, you know, this is where we are. But I think, yeah, if you're, you know, we listen to Teresa and Renee who do mutual aid work. If you are an incarcerated individual, if you're an immigrant who doesn't know where they're going to get food from because they haven't gotten any economic relief during COVID at all, other than, you know, food pantries and private services, which are not robust by any means there. And they're also humiliating. You know, what do you care who the president is? They don't even know. I put dollars to donuts. Many of them won't even know who the president is because it's of so little importance to their lives when you're struggling just to figure out a way to eat day to day. It's a really sad situation for millions and millions of people. And the answer we've gotten from our government right now is $600. You know, increased enforcement of immigration. And an expansion of foreign wars. There's even things in this COVID relief bill that have to do related to military expenses. And I haven't dug in. I've seen some preliminary reports. But again, our priorities aren't changing, man. They just don't seem to be changing from one administration to the next.
The Navy's getting $19 billion. There's a substantial amount of foreign aid that's going to be going out into the world. But yeah, piggybacking on all that, we are only going to get $600. And almost a third of this country, I've looked into it, about 29% of this country is food insecure. So that's almost 3 out of 10, almost a third of Americans, many of them children, don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And then we have Republicans and Democrats squabbling over anywhere from $600 to $2,000. I mean, we have tiny countries that are giving out that money. And unfortunately, if Americans weren't working and if Americans were collecting a paycheck, that would give them a lot more time to think about the world. And I think if you look at, you know, the growth of Black Lives Matter in the COVID era, I think you would have seen an explosion in other areas of activism, other areas of thought, because people would have had that time. It's almost as if they don't want people to not work. They want people to keep working. So if people are working, they're busy, and they won't start to question the problems of the world. And, you know, I think that a lot of that happened when a lot of white America saw George Floyd die. They saw him get murdered by police. A lot of them woke up. And I think a lot of people were collecting paychecks and not worrying about where their next meal or where the money was going to come from, that, you know, we would be living in a different country right now. But, you know, that goes.
Yeah. Sorry, my children are fighting in the background right there. What you heard was somebody getting hit by something.
Yeah,
I'm glad I have off tonight. I'm glad I only have to talk to you if you're a few minutes on the porch rather than run a whole show. So thanks again. But I mean, as we go forward with Revolution Radio into 2021, man, it's this kind of issue that we need to shed light on from an independent perspective. You know, and because, you know, like we've said, you know, it's not going to get any better for the activists and the people on the ground, but we've got our piece in the fight. And talked to a friend of ours, Africa, on the phone the other day, who I love, and he's awesome, even though he doesn't know anything about vaccines and, you know, stop trying to be a doctor. But you know, we talked about having a vision and what it means to have a vision, and you know, we've got a vision for things here at Revolution Radio. We're going to spend some time over the next few weeks putting it together, and we hope to, you know, get better information out there regarding a lot of topics, including immigration. But, you know, be a voice that clearly the regular press is just not prepared. I mean, if it's going to be 4 years of this, it's going to be very depressing and very hard to watch mainstream media, because it's going to be so departed from the truth, because Joe Biden is just like a savior to all mankind right now. And it's just so... Come on, man. Like, come on. Like, all right. But it's really overboard right now. It's really overboard. It's nothing but how great this guy is. And I'm sorry. He's a human being. And no matter how much you like him, please admit he has a flaw or two already, because, geez, the drool fest is so sickening.
Yeah, it's frustrating. Like, I'll say what I've always said. Low energy. you know, Joe Biden ran a low energy campaign and a lot of it was uninspiring. And, you know, we're going to see that. And then in 2 years, with more elections, we'll see how that goes with House votes. But yeah, I mean, thanks for coming on, Brian. It's not New Jersey Revolution Radio without Brian Powers. So this is the last show before the end of the year, the last show before Christmas. So we needed to see your pretty face one more time.
I can't wait to watch the interview with Dr. Hickel. I'll be on the comments, man. Thanks a lot. And if I don't see it, have a Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to everybody.
Merry Christmas.
I do a bong rip off of Everybody Knows. Everybody's met Lennon before, my double chambered bong. So, you know, we used to have a drink. I should broke out that in my family, we have a little bit of schnapps. And then, you know, me and the cousins go for a walk, you know. So I just, let's celebrate with my audience. We have to do commercial. We have to plug your events or something.
I got some plugs. Yes, I got some plugs. So number one, the first thing I want to plug is us, New Jersey Revolution Radio. It is the holiday season. It is the giving season. And if you got a couple bucks left over, please donate to New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can give whatever you want. And it's easy. You just go to NewJerseyRevolutionRadio.com. /donate. Easy peasy, easy peasy. Second of all, if you're still looking for a gift, what was that?
We don't have any music, but if I do bong rips in the background, it adds a little of an ambiance for you.
If you are looking for a gift and you want to educate that loved one and you're looking to do it on the cheap, they can go to Commizon and buy a book from New Jersey Revolution Radio. Again, NewJerseyRevolutionRadio.com/shop. And the book we have available is called No More Measles, The Truth About Vaccines and Your Health by Lori Endicott Thomas. He has been featured on New Jersey Revolution Radio a number of times, and it's under $4. So for under $4, you can educate yourself. You can get a good gift for yourself or for a loved one, and I think it'd be something to consider. Big things coming with New Jersey Revolution Radio. People should stay tuned. Before my next guest gets on, I do...
Hold on. You got one more. We got to sponsor the August Agency, www.theaugustagency.biz. Is tax season's coming around? So we're getting our 1099s together for our contractor. If you're a contractor, you got to get your tax filings in. There's all kinds of stuff related to COVID, business expenses. Call Charlie at the August Agency. Check him out, www.theaugustagency.biz. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy holidays, whatever you celebrate. Peace.
Merry Christmas, Brian. Take care. So before my next guest comes on, Dr. Hickel, I do want to give a short plug. So way back on July 24th, 2015, I published episode 3 of my podcast, Modernity and Absurdity. And the title of that episode was Bernie and Black Lives Matter. So in that episode, I sat myself and the amazing professor, not quite yet, Dr. Hickel, we're talking about what that new Black Lives Matter organization was all about. I'm sure you've heard about them. And I don't know, maybe something happened to them. We don't know what happened to them. And we also discussed what happens, because again, this is 2015 before the 2016 elections. We also talked about the grift of running for president and how Mitt Romney is kind of the guy who popularized that. And initially in 2015, Donald Trump has never stopped being a grifter. He never stopped being a con man. And best case scenario for him worked out. He ended up becoming president of the United States. Worst case scenario is he probably would have ended up with a book deal or a television talking deal or another TV show. Check out the episode. Let me know what you think about it. You can always find me, PerezPodcast@gmail.com, @PerezPodcast on Twitter. Check it out. Episode 3, Modernity and Absurdity, Bernie and Black Lives Matter, from July 4th, 2015. It's only about an hour. So check it out. Let me know what you think. And Leah, if Dr. Hickel is in the studio, if you could bring him in, that would be great. And there he is. I'm the only Dr. Hickel. How you doing, Flavio?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming on this evening.
Yeah, I'm psyched. I have to go back and re-listen to that that podcast we did, you know, so long ago. And it's, you know, yeah, I was not a doctor yet at that point, but we were thinking about Black Lives Matter was just sort of breaking out, and we were trying to think through what does that mean, and how did that play out, I think, in the 2016 election context. So, yeah, I have to go back and listen and see if what we were talking about still makes sense or not, or panned out.
It was
so,
right after Black Lives Matter activists confronted Bernie Sanders at the Netroots Nation conference. So it was right after that. And we were like, why aren't they going after Hillary? What's going on here? Why are they only singling out Bernie? But if people want to know what we were talking about, I mean, check out the episode. It's about an hour. I think it's a great conversation. And it just flows. We're just two guys having a talk, and that's great. So piggybacking on that, I want to continue. There's something I want to throw out here, and then I'm going to work it into a question, Flavio. In July and August, Pew conducted a poll asking what issues Americans felt were very important. So they asked a number of Americans, and in this instance, of course, we're going to look at Latinos or Latinx people. And the Pew poll found that among Latinx people, the most important issue for the election in 2020 was the economy at 80%. Not abortion, not immigration, not machismo and feminism. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and so the first thing I'll notice, because you mentioned it twice now, is what terms do we use, right? And I agree. I personally don't like, number one, the terms used are your own, right? I mean, people are allowed to use whatever terms that they feel most comfortable describing themselves with, obviously. But I think I share with you, I don't personally like Hispanic because it's not, I'm Brazilian. It's not inclusive of people who speak Spanish, right? And the other thing to keep in mind is that these terms are all imposed, right? They don't mean anything. Most of the time they don't mean anything to first generation immigrants, right? When you come over, you identify with national origin. And the only time a collective Latino identity is really going to be significant is when the society makes it so that it's significant, right? So the reason why Latinos come to adopt this identity is because they face systems of oppression that make it meaningful to collectively organize and that sort of thing. Now, Latinx, I use Latinx when I write academically because I like the idea of writing in more inclusive language. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. It doesn't flow off the tongue, right? I mean, so I will probably use Latino more often than not in our casual conversation here. And actually studies are showing, I think like Pew studies and things like that I think it's something like only like 5 to 10% of Latinos in America will prefer or have heard of or understand the term Latinx, right?
It'll be a time before it'll be a while before it takes off. It's coming.
But the other point about immigration, right? So yeah, I think there is a politicians and pundits, they like to insist that if you want to understand Latino public opinion or Latino voters, you have to think about immigration. And look, immigration is phenomenally important to people of Latin American descent because many of us know people, family, friends, that are going through that experience, that are, more closely connected to that experience. So immigration matters. But there's no new finding there, right? For the last, decade or more, the top issue for Latinos has always been, the economy, healthcare, education, not that dissimilar for most Americans, right? And that makes sense because particularly if you are a sort of marginalized group, you're often, fighting economically, right, to sustain and to advance and things like that. So issues of the economy are always going to be sort of number one. I think what is worth pointing out, though, is that immigration does tend to be more important to Latino voters than to Anglo voters, although with Trump, and there's certainly moments of heightened nativism where that sometimes changes for different reasons, right? But generally speaking, Latinos do think immigration is more important than other voters, and they definitely have different attitudes, more or less, than other voters. But there is a lot of nuance there, which I'm sure you will ultimately ask me about. So,
Well, I mean, speaking of nuance, I mean, I just want to put it into context because a lot of people were kind of stunned. And I think we were chatting about this earlier. We're going to kind of use about 30% of Latinos voting for Trump. That's the number we're looking at for 2020. Can you put that in its historical context? Because at first, that is something that is shocking to think, 3 out of 10 Latinos are supporting Donald Trump. But when you look back in history, you say, all right, well, Ronald Reagan got 35% support among Latinos. George Bush, Jesus, in 2004, I'll never forget that election, got 40% support among Latinos. So is there anything you could tell us about that trend? Do you see it going up? Do you see it going down? Is it going to go anywhere in particular? I mean, it stayed pretty steady in that 25 to 30% area, more or less.
Yeah, and that's a great insight, right? And you're absolutely right. it's generally been pretty stable. I don't think there's any reason to expect dramatic change, right? Yeah, I mean, so going all the way back to Reagan, about 3 out of 10, more or less, depending on the election, depending on some of the issues at stake, how much the candidates have reached out to the Latino community. 3 out of 10 Latinos are voting for the Republican Party, right? They'd express conservative attitudes on a variety of issues, right? That's a pretty standard number. George Bush was higher in 2004. Now, a lot of that probably is a function of, you know, we're talking about, you know, post 9/11, fairly nationally popular George Bush, although I think we all would agree for all the wrong reasons, right? But Bush is in general fairly popular. Bush also made at least superficial efforts to connect with Latino voters, right? I mean, you know, speaking Spanish, he comes from Texas, he did some outreach there, right? So, I mean, in all these ways, it's certainly higher, but it's not totally, totally surprising. But yeah, 3 out of 10 Latinos have consistently supported the Republican Party. And I think that in 2020, it's not clear exactly what's happening, right? So the first thing I would say is, you know, exit poll always a bit iffy, right? So not to get too into the weeds, but with an exit poll, you are literally interviewing people as they leave the polling site, right? You're doing you're randomly asking people, who did you vote for? What do you think about these issues, et cetera, et cetera. There's always going to be some issues with, are you getting a good enough random poll? Are people actually talking to you, right? So there's always about the veracity of exit polls, but in 2020, it's much more challenging given everything with COVID, right? A lot of people were not voting in person. Now, they did supplement these polls with phone calls and things like that, but the Latino population in particular is very difficult to reach, right? You've got language issues, you've got issues about, they often, they may be working at times when, a lot of times these survey calls are being done. So for a variety of reasons, they're a particularly difficult population to sample. So you have some people talking about Latinos going 40% for Donald Trump, or, and some are saying that only 20%, right? And it's really hard to definitively say what's the right or wrong answer. If I had to put money on it, I think we're at about where we've been. And I don't think there's any reason to think that's going to change, right? I mean, if Donald Trump move the Latino community to be more decidedly Democratic, then it's hard to imagine what could, in a lot of ways. So I don't personally see that number changing. I think that that's going to be pretty durable.
Pretty durable. Yeah. I want to toss a scenario out you before, because I want to talk to you about how immigrant groups, in particular Latinos, mobilize, organize. If you can, tell us about social identity theory and social mobility. But there's an idea I want to throw by you. I was chatting about this with my wife, and I'm of the opinion that without COVID, Donald Trump wins, right? That white America has a particular view of Donald Trump. Black America has a particular view of Donald Trump. But with COVID, how did I word this? I guess I wanted to put it a certain way. How does a lack of COVID, right? So COVID creates insecurities about jobs, insecurities about your health. How do you think, and this is purely speculation, a lack of COVID would have affected the Latino population's vote, right? Because I'm of the opinion that Donald Trump, right, we're in a storm, 2020 is a storm, COVID's a storm, and Donald Trump is a piece of driftwood in a storm, right? He's a racist. He's openly racist. But at the end of the day, I need a job. I got to feed my kids. I got to feed my family. And Donald Trump is going to get me back to work.
It's a great question. Yeah, it's a really great question, right? So what happens? So we're playing the...
Are these people beholden to capitalism? Are they so indebted and beholden... Thank you, Peter. Peter giving us the shout out. Are they so tied into the system that it's like they don't have the privilege to think about immigration? They don't have the privilege to think about abortion. It's like, I need a job. These government checks are not coming. I need a job now. And one of the big areas they were talking about is in 538 was Starr County, Texas. Now, Starr County is 99% Latino. So you're going to get that percentage of conservatives anyway. But there was a sharp increase, about 55% in voting for Trump, right? So looking at that, are they Trumpers Or is this a county with a $29,000 median income? These are people with blue collar jobs. Are they desperate people trying to get back to work? And I'm sorry, I keep building on that and elaborating. What do you think about that, Flavio?
There's a lot to unpack there for sure, right? I mean, the question of what happens to Trump in 2020 without COVID, right? Imagine COVID never happened. And I'm glad you focused on Latino because, man, that gets really tough thinking about it as the nation. One thing we can say is absent COVID, the economy probably still would have been doing what it was doing, which for most people was pretty good, right? I mean, like, we're all coming at this from a leftist political orientation where we think that we could be doing much better socially, economically, racially marginalized groups in society, right? Like, we're all at that front. But generally speaking, the economy was doing fairly well. So absent COVID, I think you're right. I think Trump is coming into this with a stronger economy. And that would certainly change things, right? Trump would likely still be in the identity politics game a lot harder, right? So he would be in 2020. He sort of avoided talking about immigration.
Nobody even talked about it.
I mean, in 2018, that was the one ad that the White House released in 2018 for the midterm election was of, right? So the Trump campaign was still doubling down on immigration as the number one issue to push them over the edge in 2018. By 2020, they said, we can't do this anymore, right? We have to focus on, you know, the economy and how we'll bring the economy back. So I don't know. Absent the economy, I think you'd say that Trump is probably continuing to double down on immigration with the, you know, for Latinos in particular, right? Most of my research is showing that that you probably have somewhere in the ballpark of, like, you know, 30% of Latinos that are not liberal on immigration, right? Some of the newer projects I'm working on now look at to what degree are Latinos actually resentful of the undocumented, right? So the idea that the undocumented are making us look bad or something like that, right? This sort of, you know, and we can talk more about how that works and operates, but what I'm getting at is that I think, you know, these are not people that are going to be that are going to change, right? They're not going to go liberal. They're going to continue supporting Trump. If he doubles down on immigration, they're going to stick with them. So, you know, absent COVID, I don't think the Latino numbers changed that dramatically. But it would have been interesting to see, right? It would have been interesting to see what he would have done with immigration, and would there have been a sort of tipping point in which Latinos rebelled? I'm with you, though, right? I mean, what inspired a lot of my recent research on Latino politics and attitudes is the fact that how are, like, 30% of Latinos voting for this guy that is putting kids in cages? And look, I think Brian had a great, you know, introduction there talking about the issues, and I'm sure you guys probably got into this before, where this stuff predates Trump, right? Obama set the stage for much of what get into warp speed, right? But, like, the foundations were there, right? The child separation and a lot of these policies were already there. Trump just ramped them up. So, you know, but so it still surprises me why 3 in 10 Latinos are, you know, going for Trump, given that it has exacerbated, right?
I'm thinking, like, without COVID, people have more time to sit there and not freak out about a job, to sit there and think about these other issues. And I just, COVID was so, it was like a Hulk. It was like a gorilla busting into the room. It turned everything on its head. I mean, it's COVID. It just went berserk on all of us.
I mean, it's possible that the simple counterfactual would be, let's think back to 2016 then. Yeah. Right. So absent COVID, right, this is how people behaved. You know, Trump loses the popular vote, but he's still captures, like, you know, 48% of the national population. He still captures, like, 30 some odd percent of the Latino vote. And I think that says something scary about, you know, America and even about the Latino community. I mean, what the bigger project that I think I'm trying to work on in general is that we have this assumption automatically work together, right? This idea of linked fate, right? We're all in the same marginalized group. We all face the same kind of problems. We should all automatically work together, vote together. And often as organizers or politicians do this much more than we do, I think, people on the ground, but we often make this kind of assumption that we can talk to all Latinos the same way or something like that. And it's just not true, right? And I think what my research is trying to do is let's identify the spots where Latinos do disagree, so that organizers can sort of think up strategies of how we can find then the commonality, right, to bring these communities. Right, so that's the sort of broader goal. I ultimately want to get, you know, reduce that 30% to 20 to 10 to 0. You can only do that by understanding why people are going the other way.
Yeah, it's just, it's just one of those things. I think we'll never know. I mean, do you get the same referendum on Trump without COVID? I mean, I'm of the opinion like Trump really could have handled COVID a lot better. All he had to do was say, "Hey, people, wear masks," but it was just like he didn't do it. And I don't know. I feel like if it was somebody smarter, somebody slicker, it could have done, they could have had done a lot more damage. It's almost like I'm thankful Trump's not that bright because it could have been a lot worse.
No, I would totally agree with you that I think, I think Trump completely mishandled in an epic way this entire COVID scenario. And I think you're right. I think if Trump had simply told people, look, wear masks and kept doing those sort of, daily or weekly press conferences, he probably would have kept enough of these middling folks to stick with them another 4 years, right? Yeah. Because it is a crisis, and generally speaking, American politics, we stick with the leader during a crisis. That's what we do. So, I think that's a great point.
It boggles my mind. I never understood what people see in that guy. But so before we were talking about like in groups, you were talking about linked fate. Can you give us a brief, can you please tell us what social identity theory is and how it relates to the work that you're doing?
Yeah. So, So social identity theory is this, this academic theory that begins in, several decades ago, and it's been built on ever since. And the basic premise is that it's very easy for people to categorize themselves, even arbitrarily, right? So yeah. I could randomly say you're on the red team, you're on the people will internalize that, right?
Yeah.
So our identities matter. They influence our self-esteem. And there is a natural inclination, a basic human psychology, which says I need to advance the interests of my group more than anything else, right? Because that's going to influence my own self-esteem, right? So that's the fundamental base of social identity theory. And there's offshoots that say you may view politics as a zero-sum game and be hostile towards those that are competitive groups and things of that nature. But, so for my research, we're thinking of, well, who are these 30% that are voting for Trump, right? What's going on there? And the kernel of an idea that I got was just from talking to people in my orbit, extended family and things like that. It felt like there were a lot of people, a lot of Latinos I was talking to that said, well, these immigrants are different from me, right? Mm-hmm. I'm more American than I'm Latino, or, and this was sort of the idea. They kept talking about how important being an American was over this sense of shared solidarity with their, with this marginalized group and that sort of thing. So we looked at that, and what we found was that Latinos, being an American is more important than being a Latino, were significantly more likely to support Trump. And, we did complicated statistical models, which are available. This is going to be published in Public Opinion Quarterly pretty soon, but you can always email me, and I'd be happy to talk with anyone, get through the specifics. But prioritizing an American identity over a Latino identity is basically on par with the influence of your party identity, right? So even controlling for the fact that people are Republican, right? Prioritizes American identity still matters, right? So the bottom line is Trump supporters among Latinos are those that say being an American is more important than being Latino. And the question is, well, why might they do that? And really, we're still trying to get at it. The article that we're publishing now, it should be out, COVID has slowed down the publishing timeline, but it's been accepted. It should be out early next year. The argument we make basically is that when you're a marginalized group, your self-esteem is inevitably going to be a little bit lower, right? Because if your self-esteem is tied to the status of your group, if you're a relatively low status group in American society, you want to elevate that. So how can you go about elevating your self-esteem and your identity? The first option that's been identified by social identity theorists is passing, right? I'm going to ditch my low status group and join a high status group. And in the United States, you have that, right? Because ostensibly, anyone can be, not about blood or skin tone or anything like that. It's just about ideas, right? Adopt these American ideas, democracy, liberty, individual, you know, responsibility, and pick yourself up by your own bootstraps, et cetera, et cetera. You adopt all that, you can be an American, right? And yeah. So that's one way you can build up your self-esteem. And so some people do that, right? And yeah. That's what we're identifying here. But what we still have to sort of work on developing and gathering more data is that obviously not everyone can do this, right? Yeah. Particularly in America, where race colors how people identify you, right? And determines whether you will be considered an American or not. There's some people that simply can't pass, right? People don't let them pass, right? They can't, they just can't do it. And those folks that feel like they can't pass, the only way to then improve your self-esteem and the status of your social group is to fight to elevate that status, right? So this can be done by more revolutionary action, right? The kind of work that you guys are talking about here, where you're organizing, where you're trying to change laws and organize people to fight back against policies that marginalize community or other communities, right? That's one option, right? And those are the people that, frankly, are voting against Trump, right? And that's the basic dichotomy. And we can split hairs a little bit more on that, you know, but that's the basic dichotomy there.
Would you happen to have the racial background or the national origin? Are you finding any of that data, like differences? Like, obviously, we know Cubans, white Cubans from 50 years ago, are tending to be more conservative. We can count on that. You know, a lot of young Puerto Ricans in New York will probably be more liberal. We can make those generalizations, but looking more into it, looking more specifically at different different ethnic groups, are you seeing any? Are you looking at like racial and ethnic differences among Latinos? Is that a question? National origin, is that something that's coming up, or is that something that you're not really seeing?
No. So any study you want to do on Latino public opinion and political science, you need to control for national origin, right? So the biggest groups in American society, number one, Mexicans, right? So you always control for
that. Like 85%.
Right. And then you've got, you've got Puerto Ricans, you've got Cubans, and sometimes you'll do El Salvadorans, mm-hmm. but every other, even El Salvador, I think it's like of the U.S. Latino population. So we normally control for those three, right? I do not myself detect much of a statistical difference here. I'm just looking at my models, right? I have them on my other screen. Much is made about Cubans, right? And frankly, I have not seen it, right? In running these, particularly when we look at the other predictors. So what predicts Trump support in general, right? It's party. Right? Are you Republican? Number one, obviously. Are you conservative? Obviously. Racial resentment, right? Are you basically racist, right? That predicts Trump. Are you a sexist? That predicts Trump, right? So so once we control for those kind of things, the influence of being Cuban or not Cuban, like, doesn't really materialize in studies, yeah. right? So I think you're right. Yeah, there are Cuban communities where conservative ideas are more predominant, right? That's certainly the case. But I think painting with a broad brush is it's time that we start reevaluating these assumptions that we have, right? So that's one thing I would say. So I don't see any statistical differences between national origin groups on looking at attitudes towards DACA or building the wall or about general attitudes towards the undocumented. I don't national origin stuff. Now, okay. I do think that race might matter, right? And this is a new line of research that I'm going to be starting very soon where, I am phenotypically white, right? I am white Latino, right? I have a different experience than a lot of other Latinos, right? The ability to pass as an American, for example, is significantly easier for me than a lot of other Latinos may face. So The argument that I'm sort of working on is trying to evaluate to what degree do we see sort of racial differences manifesting along those kind of lines, right? Do we see a lack of solidarity, for example, among white Latinos compared to Latino communities kind of thing? Because it's easier for them to pass, or they're not going through the same struggles and things like that. Now, I don't have the data to back that up, but I think I strong gut hunch that phenotype can matter, and it's about trying to investigate that and really interrogate and find the nuance there.
It's something that we definitely have to look into, because the face of immigration in the United States is I would say it's a brown face, a native face, an Indian face. You know what I mean? That's the idea. So for a lot of Latinos who don't look like that, who might be mixed like me, or might be, you know, just black or just white, they're going to have certain attitudes that might be different to those than those groups. What about generational breakdowns? Is there anything you've come across among generational breakdowns? So, for instance, like, we know that Cubans born since 2000, you know, tend to not be as conservative as their grandparents. I always like to joke about like families in Texas and California that are Mexican and they've been there for hundreds of years, but they don't necessarily have dark skin or speak Spanish. They might be blonde hair, blue eyes, and have a name. What is your research showing about generational differences?
Yeah, I mean, so generation is one, and it's not just me, right? I mean, there's a long line of Latino politics literature that shows, that generation matters. The farther away you are from the immigrant generation, the more assimilated you become, right? And generally speaking, the more you are to be sort of, conservative. Not that you're going to be conservative, but you're going to be more conservative than you're going to be less liberal, for example, than let's say the first generation or something like that, right? And there's, I have a buddy that I worked on my recent paper with. He did a whole study on denial of racism, and he found that, older generation folks are more likely to deny that racism exists, right? And that sort of, so we do see some of those differences happening. So that's definitely true. Although what's interesting is, it doesn't, again, when you control for everything else, right? Yeah. When you account for the fact that we're also measuring racism and religiosity and all this other stuff, generation doesn't become a really big factor in predicting attitudes towards Trump or immigration or a lot of these other issues. But you're right. Older generation, the bigger issue, I think, and this is another new area that I'm looking into, the newer generation immigrant, Latin American immigrant, is often coming from Central America, right? Me and some of my colleagues, we sort of are curious about whether there might be some, resentment, within the Latin American family, we don't all get along with each other. We don't always, sort of view each other in the most positive light. So is there some element where, let's say, a third generation Cuban or a third generation Mexican or Puerto Rican might look and be like, oh, it's these new immigrants from El Salvador, from Guatemala, right? I mean, like, these guys are giving all Latinos, right? I mean, like, giving all of us a bad name or something, right? Like, is there something, is that happening? We're not sure yet, but we do want to investigate, because I think anecdotally,
it's happening anecdotally,
these kind of things, right? So, and, anecdotes can be a good source of inspiration for research. I mean, you obviously have to do the research and get the data and see if it pans out, but if it's happening in your community among people you're organizing with, then there might be something there, right? It's worth probably checking out, right? So,
I agree. In terms of anecdotes, just for everyone paying attention out there, an anecdote is where you start the investigation, right? Mm-hmm. And the plural of anecdote is not evidence. And I think people need to be aware of that. And, it's like the whole Bigfoot debate, right? Just because you said you saw Bigfoot doesn't mean that Bigfoot's real. What can you tell me about some of the stereotypes you've smashed regarding Latinos? Like, is machismo a factor? Is it Catholic God or Pentecostalism coming out of Central America? We're looking at polls. We see the economy as number one. What role is machismo playing? Well, what role is you know, chauvinism playing? Are you, is that a thing? Are we seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't smash it because I haven't published the paper yet. I haven't even written the paper yet, but I have looked at some data, and thus far, you know, I don't, you know, so in terms of sexism and machismo, right? Look, I mean, yeah, according to my early analysis, and again, more has to be done. It still has to be peer reviewed, right? I mean, and all that. But my early analysis gives some indication that yes, Latinos on average do tend to be somewhat more sexist than other racial groups in America, right? There does appear to be some evidence for that. Again, it's not definitive, and I would not stake my reputation on it. I don't want people repeating me on that, but some evidence of that. But what's interesting is, you know, and yeah, Latinos that are sexist are more likely to vote for Trump than Latinos that aren't sexist, right? But being Latino and sexist, you know, they actually vote for Trump still less than Anglo-sexists, right? So I guess what I'm getting at is so much has been made in 2020 about Latino machismo. Like, why, you know, why are Latinos voting for Biden? Oh, it must be machismo. And it's like, if you're going to talk about sexism in the Latino community, which we should talk about because it's a problem, you also need to talk about it in other communities, right? And the way the discourse was framed was like, this is a unique or an extra big problem in the Latino community. And again, my at least early results say that's not the case, right? It is more of an issue going on in other communities. On the religion front, I actually don't have much to report there, except to say that I think that we need to start talking about Protestantism more and born again more. We think about Latino and what's, you know, so it, at least from an academic standpoint, we always look at, are they Catholic or are they not Catholic, right? Because Catholic is the predominant religion, obviously, right? But like the growing, you know, Protestantism and particularly born again evangelicalism is just growing at such a rapid rate throughout Latin America, particularly in Brazil, right? You know, where a lot of my attention is. And that appears to be more politically salient, right? Being Catholic is sort of like just the general sauce that's part of being Latino, right? But it does appear, at least some evidence that I found so far, that Protestantism may have some effects there, that they do tend to be more conservative on a variety of issues. And so that would be something to think about moving
forward. Okay. Yeah. What other salient points have you come across? Has there been any findings in your data that like blew your mind? Did you have any assumptions that were overturned? Anything salient that you can share with us that you've come across in your research?
Honestly, I was really bummed out to discover that. I guess I was hoping that Latino machismo was not a thing, right? Yeah. So basically in the data, it's a national sample, right, that I rely on, the American National Election Study. It's done every, every 4 years. It's done at the University of Michigan. It is like the gold standard of political science data sets. They ask a variety of questions about attitudes towards women, attitudes about feminism, et cetera, et cetera. I was disappointed to see that, at least according to their Latino sample, that Latinos were more sexist than some other groups.
Okay, so it's not massively high, but higher than everyone else.
It is, yeah, and that was disappointing on a personal level, right? But on the other hand, we shouldn't be disappointed, right? I mean, what that suggests, particularly you know, a show like this that's about you know organizing and making change, is that we need to do more. Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe I was overly optimistic about what, you know, how far Latino community had come and we have come afar, but like clearly more has to be done. And I guess that's the takeaway. That's the silver line, not silver lining, but you know, that should be the takeaway from that.
Okay, great. I just got one more question for you before we start to wrap this up. Polling, right? Americans have mixed feelings on polls. Polls have not been as what's the word? People, we have been off with polls. Whether it's Nate Silver, whether it's pundits, whether it's exit polls, whether it's polling on Trump, why should we still trust polls? Are they still relevant? Are they still necessary in gathering data?
It's a fair question, right? The one thing I would say is like when you look at 2016, right? The polls in general were pretty close, right? And you probably have read a ton of articles came out right before the 2020 election talking about this, right? So I don't have to rehash. You know, generally speaking, they were pretty close. There were some identified problems that they tried to fix in 2020. But clearly, if you were just watching the 2020 results come in, I mean, I was looking at it like, man, Florida is like 5 points off. You know, like that's a pretty big error, right? 5 percentage points. Now, there's all kinds of excuses we can make for it. But bottom line, polling is there is a struggle. Now, polls in general, I would say, are pretty accurate, right? To still predict what's going to happen within a 5-point error range is still pretty good when you really think about it, right? The issue that polling has right now is there's a real struggle with identifying some segment of Trump voter, right? So Trump voters, and the prevailing theory is that, look, Trump voters are distrustful, you know, particularly some of the more extreme ones, right? They believe in the deep state and all the conspiracy theories that you talk about on your podcast and in your work, and they're not going to answer a survey, yeah, right? They're just not. And there's a lot of Trump voters.
Is the conspiracy manifest?
Yeah, right, exactly. And there's a lot of Trump voters that are, you know, this, you know, sort of, you know, the narrative of the working class voter, and that's, I think, over exaggerated, but there's some truth to it, right? Where these are just hard people to reach, right? They work odd hours. They're just not answering their phones as a general point, right? So the bottom line is the polling industry has struggled with being able to contact enough people that they can get a more accurate polling, right? So there's challenges there. I still think polling is a worthwhile activity to do, right? And just consider the alternative. If we didn't do polling, we'd have no scientific way to try and understand what people think, right? It would just be anecdotes. And I think you actually put it super well, right? Like, the plural of anecdotes is not evidence, right? I mean, I've never heard that before, but like, it's brilliant. I'm gonna steal that from my research about this class, right?
That's because, not me.
Either way, if we didn't have polling, that's all we would have is a collection of these anecdotes. And yeah, polling's got its challenges. So does everything in society. Right? The point of society is to always be striving for better, right? So I think the key is polling has to figure out what are we failing at and how can we start fixing it?
Yeah, so, I think that's a great way to put it. All right, cool. I mean, if I'm a gadfly and I want to look into Latinx politics and whatnot, where can I go? Any websites you look up? I mean, I'm probably going to be looking at Texas. I'm going to be looking at Florida. For liberal politics, probably New York, New Jersey, Chicago. But any particular websites you look at for information, Flavio?
I mean, I do not have a specific you know, online outlet for Latino politics or something like that. I mean, I think that some of the standard ones that you might find, you know, places like that are great. You can check that out. Certainly, I mean, you want to know more about what I'm doing? I'm not very active on social media, but you can find me on Twitter at Flavio Hickel Jr. 1. You can email me at FlavioHickelJr@gmail. And I can certainly answer any questions you might have about Latino public opinion and political science. And that would be my sort of thoughts on it.
Sounds good. Thank you for coming on, Flavio. You're a good friend. You're a brilliant man. And any last minute plugs you want to get in as we wrap it up?
I've known you since college. I'm happy to do the show. This has been a great conversation. I'm really, I think what you guys are doing here is fantastic. So keep up the good work and thanks for having me.
Thanks again, Flav. Anytime. Again, thanks for coming on. Folks, thank you for paying attention. Thank you for following New Jersey Revolution Radio. For those interested, you can check me out, Modernity and Absurdity, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, available at Perez Podcast on Twitter. And again, if you can, check out Modernity and Absurdity, Episode 3, Bernie and Black Lives Matter, with the great Professor Flavio Hickel.
Let us know what we got wrong at this point.
Yeah, right? Let us know what we got wrong. And if anything happens with that Black Lives Matter organization. For everyone at New Jersey Revolution Radio, for Leah, for Brian, for Flavio, thank you, folks. And hope to see you again. We'll be coming back in January. Peace. Take care. New Jersey Revolution Radio. Take care of yourselves out there.